We'll start with one topic from this coming week's Sedra, and if there's time, we'll try something else too. Says that Yaakov Avinu, thank you, blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, and he said that the Jewish people will bless their children using Ephraim and Manasseh as the base. Yisimcha Elokim ke Ephraim v'chi Manasseh v'yosem es Ephraim v'chi Manasseh. That God should make you, put you like Ephraim and Manasseh, and he made it his point to mention Ephraim, even though he was the younger, before Manasseh, who was the older one. The obvious question is, if we're going to bless our children, why don't we go for broke and bless them as shibli like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Or at least like Reuven, Shimon, and Levi? Why like Ephraim and Manasseh, the grandchildren? There are many answers to this. I'm going to tell you what I think. Beyond that, why does it have to be mentioned that Ephraim comes before Manasseh? Right. Why is that seemingly part of the bracha? In addition to that, the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel says that this blessing is specifically supposed to be said at a bris. When you make a bris, you're supposed to give the child the blessing, Yisimcha Elokim Kefrayim v'chim Menashe. We give the blessings on Friday night, Erev Yom Kippur, but I haven't found any minig that says this by a bris. So why is it for a bris and why don't we say it? So we'll try to answer all those things. The first point that we need as a preface to what I'm going to say is, what is the concept of avos? It says, Ein korin la'avos al-shlosha, you only call avos three people, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And everybody has their own personal avos, right? So why, what does that mean, that only these three are called avos? Avos, aside from meaning fathers, avos means the foundation of something. Like Shabbos, you have an av malacha, and you have the toldos. The av is the main thing that everything else emanates from that. The concept of avos is the following. We're going to preempt a little bit from 2 weeks from now, Sedra, but I'll be in the States again then. So we can, what's it called, we'll give it on credit. It says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu the following. Vo'eiro el Avram, el Yitzchak, ve'el Yaakov, bekel Shakai. I appear to Avram, to Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And God says to Moshe, I promised them a lot of things, and they never saw the fulfillment of the promise. I promised them Eretz Yisrael. Avram had to go buy burial plot for Sarah. Right? I promised them a lot of things. I never showed them the fulfillment of the promise, and they never complained. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, one time I tell you to go redeem the Jewish people, and it doesn't work out as fast as you like it, you come and complain. Chaval al da'avdin v'lomish. It's a shame that I lost such great people and they can't be found. Claim that they're lost and can't be found. Rashi, in this whole narrative, adds two words as a commentary. For Eira el Avram el Yitzchak v'Yaakov, that's what the Torah says. Rashi adds two words. For Eira el ha'avos. I appeared to the avos. Now, Rashi usually doesn't tell us things that we don't. If I had that pasuk, El Avram, El Yisov, Yaakov, I know very clearly who they are. They're the avos. They have Avraham Schwartz and Yitzchak, whatever, and Rashi has to tell me, no, this Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov is the avos. Remember from Bereishis, in case you forgot, they're the avos. Why did Rashi tell me, Vo'eir El Ha'avos? What I think is, there is a few questions on what Rashi says God intended to sell Moshe Rabbeinu. Firstly, God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, I had these great people in the world, I promised them things, I never made good on my promise, they never questioned me, they never complained. And you, the first time, you don't see the promise fulfilled as fast as you would like, you complain. It's a shame that they're lost and can't be found. First of all, the avos are lost? and they can't be found, I can tell you where they are. They're in Gan Eden. I'm sure God knows that. And beyond that, why the redundancy? If they're lost, then obviously they can't be found, because if they could be found, they wouldn't be lost. So why do I have to say twice? Chaval al da'avdim v'lo mishtachim. It's a shame that they're lost and can't be found. Why the double? In addition to that, I have another question. There's a famous story with the Rebbe Reb Zusha that he said that after 120 years, he's not afraid if they're going to ask him, Zusha, how come you weren't as great as the Baal Shem Tov? How come you weren't as great as the Rambam? I'll just say, I'm not the Rambam, I'm not the Baal Shem Tov, I didn't have their potential, and therefore I wasn't as great as them. You know what I'm afraid of? That after 120 years, they're going to ask me, Zusha, how come you weren't as great as Zusha? That bothers me. Why didn't you fulfill your potential? The story seems to point out that you can't demand from somebody something just because somebody else did it. Somebody else is somebody else. You can only demand what they can do. You can't demand from somebody, how come you're not like them? People a lot of times make this mistake with their children, and they demand from one what another one is capable of doing. You have to demand from each one what they're capable of doing. Not, well, your brother did that, your sister did that, right? So what? They're different people. So it seems to be a true idea. If that's the case, what's God telling Moshe Rabbeinu? Boy, I used to have these great people that I could promise things and not fulfill my promise and they wouldn't complain, and it's a shame that you're not like that. Moshe Rabbeinu should say, you know, God, what are you complaining against me? These were great people. I'm not that great. I'm not Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. I'm Moshe. But it seems like God can demand from Moshe, these people had it, how come you don't have it? But it seems like that's not something that you should be able to demand from somebody. That's why Rashi adds, Va'era el ha'avos. You're right. If I would appear to these people as individuals, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, then you're right, Moshe Rabbeinu, I have no complaint against you. How come you don't live up to what they could do? You're not them. But I didn't appear to them as individuals. I appeared to them as avos. The avos created the potential for the entire Jewish people. There are certain things that the avos did that became part of the wellsprings of potential of every Jew. What they are is what we are. We have within us them. It's part of our genes, our spiritual genes. It's part of our genetic makeup. There's a gene pool that comes from the avos that we are capable of doing because they were capable. Maybe not on the same exact intense level, but the same ideas. And therefore, we have within us the avos, because they were avos. They weren't just individuals. But they were the creators of the potential of the Jewish people. And every single Jew has some of those qualities within it. Not all the qualities of the avos passed on like that. But there were certain avos qualities that are found in every Jew, because we come from the avos. Therefore, the Rabban Shem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Vo'era el Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, as Rashi adds, el ha'avos. And therefore, part of the psyche of the Jewish people, which we inherited spiritually from our avos, is the ability to have faith in God, that even if we don't see the fulfillment of the promise, not to complain and not to question. It's part of our makeup. And if we don't do it, it's not because we can't, it's because we're not living up to our potential. That's what the Rabban Shem said to Moshe. I'm not trying to compare you to individuals. I'm telling you that within you should exist this quality, because this is something that comes from the avos. And it's a shame that it's lost and can't be found in you. That's what it means. Not that they're lost, but what they created should be found within you. It's a shame that it's lost and can't be found within you. That's what the Rabban Shem say to Moshe Rabbeinu. Comes out that the concept of avos is the concept of whatever they achieved. And that includes the imahos too, because the avos and imahos are one. Ishto ke gufo, baal ke ishto, a husband and wife are considered one person. That's why Hanukkah, right, we never have a chance to speak about Hanukkah, but even though you light separate menorahs, mehadrim and alhadrim, for everybody in the family, every girl according to some, every boy, right, lights their own menorah. The only one who doesn't light a separate menorah is the wife. Husband and wife light one menorah together, because they're one person. In my family, we have the minig because of that, right, that I make the brachas, and I light Let's say the second night. I light the first candle. My wife lights the second candle. Since we're one person, so what difference does it make if I use this hand to light the candle or that hand to light the candle? And this way, my wife has a chance to have an active role in lighting the menorah. And even though it says that you shouldn't have somebody else light the menorah, so one person should light it. This is one person. Because if it's not one person, she should light her own menorah. So if it's one person, then this hand lights one, and this other hand lights the other one. Doesn't make a... In any case, that's an aside. Okay, I don't know of anybody else who does that, but I think that's, after thinking about it, it's a proper thing. I've been doing it for years, and it's a nice thing to do. In any case. So, the Avos and Imaos go together, and they created the potential in many areas for what every Jew is capable of doing. Now, how do I know that? How do I know that that potential of the Avos filtered down to all generations? So, you could say that, well, the Shvatim, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, had within them, right, many of the qualities of the Avos. So you see that it continued on to the next generation. But that's no proof. Because that generation grew up amongst the Avos. They grew up in Eretz Israel. So maybe because they were close to the Avos, they were exposed to the Avos, and they were born in Eretz Israel together with the Avos, that's why those qualities went on to them. But how do you know what goes on beyond that? I know that from Ephraim and Manasseh. How so? It says that Yaakov Avinu said, "V'yikarei bohem shmi, v'shem avosai Avraham v'Yitzchak. Call in them my name and the name of my forefathers." In Ephraim and Manasseh exists my name and the names of my forefathers. What does that mean, my name? We don't call them Yaakov, we don't call them Israel. They're Ephraim and Manasseh. They're not Avraham and Yitzchak. What does it mean, call them the name? The name of something represents its essence, its qualities, abilities, capabilities. That's what a name is in Hebrew. It doesn't have to necessarily mean it in the meaning of the name, but the name, the letters of the name, represent roots, spiritual roots, that represent the qualities, abilities, capabilities, talents of the thing. That's what a name represents. So it says that my name and my forefather's name is found in Ephraim and Manasseh, meaning they have the potential of the Avos. And if they have it, they weren't born in Eretz Israel. They were never exposed to the Avos from the time they were born, only much later on in life. So if they contain, and Yaakov said, they contain that same potential that the Avos created, me and my forefathers created, is in them. So if it carried on to them, there's no reason why it shouldn't carry on to every other child. So basically the fact that Ephraim and Manasseh have within them the potential of the Avos is a sign for all future generations that every Jewish child has within them the power of the Avos. Okay, now, the Avos created this power. So we can't bless our children and say, you should be like the Avos, because we don't create potential, the potential's there. What do? We realize that potential. So therefore we bless our children. The Rabban Shem should make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Just like Ephraim and Manasseh have the potential of the Avos, you also should realize that you have that potential. Okay, now, potential is a great thing. But it's not the main thing. Because potential is like yichus. Right? Yeah, family background. It's great. But Intel's, they used to say, family background is like a big zero. If you have a lot of zeros, a lot of hush of a family background, it's a lot of zeros, still zero. When does the zeros make a difference? If you put something in front of it. If you put a number in front of it, a lot of zeros becomes a big number. So family background is important if you put something in front of it, if you're somebody. But if you're a nobody, and all you can say is, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, then you end up to see still a zero. Same thing with potential. Potential is zero. If you have a lot of potential, you have a lot of zeros. If you realize that potential, then the lot of zeros becomes a big number. If you don't realize the potential, it's worthless. Therefore, Yaakov saw prophetically that even though Manasseh was the Bechor, right, he was the firstborn, and because of that, he had probably more potential than Ephraim. But Yaakov saw prophetically that Ephraim would realize more of his lesser potential than Menashe realized of his greater potential. And therefore, who's greater? Not the one with the more potential, the one who realized more of it. So he put Ephraim before Menashe. That's what we tell our children. You have the ability to be like the Avos. You have tremendous potential. Every single Jewish child has that potential. You have the potential, what's it called? It's interesting, the Stipler. It's a tremendously interesting idea. They say it in the name of Yaakov Kamenetsky also, same idea. It says that even though it's permissible to get a non-Jewish nursemaid to nurse a baby if it needs somebody to nurse it, and the mother's incapable, or the mother's not around, whatever, the mother's not alive, or whatever, one shouldn't do it, because it has an adverse effect on the baby to nurse from a non-Jewish woman. Where do we know that from? Moshe Rabbeinu. He wouldn't nurse from the Egyptians, and the Gemara says, the Medrash says, because the mouth that was going to speak to God later on shouldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman. So they ask, so what does that have to do with us? Why in the Shulchan Aruch does it say you should try to avoid letting a baby nurse from a non-Jewish woman? Because you see, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't because he was going to speak to God. How many babies speak to God, right, later on? So that's not a problem. It's a problem for Moshe Rabbeinu. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, I think the Stiplers are the same thing. You see from here that you have to treat every Jewish child that he has the potential to speak to God. He has the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? We don't know who's going to realize that potential. If Moshe wasn't anything special, he was another Jew. And every Jew has the potential. So you have to guard that potential. It may not come out, but it could. That's how you have to look at Jewish children. That means you have to look at ourselves. We all were children one day. And we all have that potential. So with children, you don't know if they're going to realize the potential or not. With us, we know already what we realized and what we didn't. But the Maisa, every Jew has the potential to be, at least in certain areas, like the Avos. How do we know that? From Ephraim and Menashe. But don't ever think that the Iker is what potential you have. The Iker is what you do with it. How much you realize of that potential. So that's what we tell our children. God should make you like Ephraim and Menashe. You should realize you're just like Ephraim and Menashe. Had the potential of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, you have that too. And you should realize, though, that Ephraim comes before Menashe. Who realizes more of the potential comes before the one who has more potential intrinsically. That's the blessing. Now, if that's the case, so I said, the reason we don't bless them that they should be like Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov directly, because they created the potential. We don't create potential, we just realize it. So at least be like Ephraim and Menashe. If we'd give us a bracha like Reuven and Shimon, who said that they have that potential? They had it because they were exposed to the Avos. But if you see Ephraim and Menashe had it, that means you have it too. There's only one problem with that. How do we bless our daughters? Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. We do bless them, they should be like the Imahos. Right? Why can we bless a girl that she should be like the Imahos, when we don't bless a boy that he should be like the Avos? So I have two answers. One the women will like, and the other one they won't like. So you can choose which one you like. I think I'll say the one you won't like first, so we'll end with the nice one that you'll remember. The first one is possibly the Imahos didn't create potential, the Avos did. They just helped the Avos create that potential. So therefore, we can't give our boys a bracha to be like the Avos because we don't create potential, we just realize it. But the girls anyway didn't create potential, so give the bracha to be like the Imahos. Second answer, which I think is taka a better answer, is that girls can create potential. Boys realize potential that they get. But a woman has the power to create life in this world, to bring new life into the world, which is a creation of new potential. So therefore a woman can have the bracha to be like the Imahos who created potential too. You can also create potential. The boys are giving the bracha, you have potential, realize it. But you're not the ones who create potential in this world. That could be the difference. In any case, so therefore, on the day of the bris, when does a child get the Jewish neshama? When does he get that full potential of the Avos? So it says on the day of the bris. it comes more at the day of the bas mitzvah or bar mitzvah. That's when it's completely polished off, and even more the day you get married, because that's when it's perfected with the full perfection, because every person is only a half a person, and when they get married, then it becomes the full potential. So it starts, the Nishmas Yisrael comes to a person at their bris, by a girl, I'm not sure, could be by birth. And then it's strengthened by bar bas mitzvah, and strengthened again by the wedding. So when do you get that potential of the avos initially? By the bris. That's why we give that bracha, by the bris. Yisimcha Elokim Kefrayim V'chim Menashe. But we don't do it. So why? The answer, I think, is because we paraphrase it. We do give that bracha, but in a paraphrase. What do we say? Kesheim shenichnas lebris, ken yikanes letorah lechupa lemaisim tovim. Right? Just like with the name. Name, we said, is all those qualities. The name that now you got by the bris, that's why we name a child by the bris. Because the name represents his potential qualities, abilities, capabilities, and talents. So the same way that you got that ability now, at the day of the bris, that's how you should develop that, the Torah, that's bar mitzvah. Chuppah is when you get married. And then it'll be complete, then you can do Maisim Tovim, then you can take that potential and realize it, and do Maisim Tovim, and actualize it. That's the purpose. You got the potential at the bris. You enhance it at the bar mitzvah, that's Torah. You enhance it more at the chuppah, and then it's complete. Now you can realize that the ikar is not what you have, potentially, how you realize it. So we really give that bracha in a paraphrase. Instead of saying it as the Torah says, Yisimcha Elokim Kefrayim, we explain it. And explain it very well in a way that makes the bracha makes more an understandable bracha than just the base bracha of Yisimcha Elokim Kefrayim V'nasha. But every Friday night, Shabbos, adds also, we become aware of our potential that we have. So we give, Shabbos also represents that potential. So we give the bracha on Shabbos, or Erev Yom Kippur. We give that bracha to our children. Because that's when it's clear what potential, who you are, what you are. Yom Kippur, you get to know who you are really deep down. And every Shabbos, you get to know a little bit more who you are. That's the bracha we give our children. Okay, any questions on that?
What's the source of the girl's bracha?
The source of the girl's bracha, I'm not sure. I hear. I'm not sure. In other words, where do we know that we shouldn't give the bracha to the girls also? Yisimcha Elokim Kefrayim V'nasha. Right? It could be. Where do we get that we give them like the emos? I'm not sure. It's a minig like that, minig Yisrael. What's the source? I have to look up now and find out. Yeah.
The double question didn't get answered.
Yeah.
That you lost.
Well, alright. So the idea is, it's not that they're lost. But in you, the quality that should be there is lost, and I can't find it. It's not. It's obviously not lost for good, because it's just dormant in you. So therefore, it's lost, but not lost forever. It's just lost and can't be found.
And it can't be.
Right, that's the idea.
I have a question about the bracha, and you don't have to answer it, because it's a little bit off track.
Okay.
I don't want to send you off track. Yitzchak, you have favor, Yahav Yitzchak at Esau, and bad came out of there. And then Yaakov favored, had a certain favoritism towards Yosef, and then also led to certain problems. Do you think Yosef would learn, and now he has these two sons, and he's shown a certain favoritism. Isn't that a certain problem that can come out of that? It always bothered me.
We find throughout the Chumash, it points out, that brothers always, right, had this dynamics, and it's always the Bechor, Kayin killed Hevel, right? In fact, some say that's why we give our children the bracha to be Ephraim and Manasseh. They're the first brothers that didn't kill each other, sell each other, whatever. There was reason to what's it called to be jealous, and they weren't jealous of each other. Right? That's the greatness of Ephraim and Manasseh. Right? That's the kind of siblings they should be. Some say that's why we give them the bracha like that. Why Yosef did it? Why Yaakov did it? Why Yaakov favored one over the other? Yaakov was the one. Yosef tried to stop him. Right. Yosef tried to stop him. Yosef said, don't do this. What's it called? Look what happened to me because of this favoritism. You do it again. It could be Yaakov saw that these wouldn't happen again. These two brothers were able to exist together without any jealousy. Okay. What? Right.
It's stronger in my head than the hatred that the brothers have.
Okay.
It's a natural thing, this sibling rivalry. So as parents, do you, in your opinion, is it something we should just accept and work with, or how?
I'll tell you what. Since you asked the question, it has nothing to do with it. It has to do with the Sedra, since we connected it to the Sedra. So I'll answer that question. The Chazal say that a person should never favor one child over another. Yafle bein bin habonim. To discriminate and give one child, he doesn't give another one. That's what Gemara says. Because look what Yaakov did. He gave Yosef some extra silk, ksonis pasim, and look what happened from it. Now, on the surface, that's absurd. Okay? For example. Okay? My daughter is getting married, so I buy her a wedding dress. My son says, hey, you didn't buy me a wedding dress, right? So I have to buy all my kids' wedding dresses, even the boys, because I bought my daughter a wedding dress, right? One child needs something, the other child doesn't need it. I have to buy all of them the same thing. I can't buy one something. The answer is very simple. A parent can get a child what they need. No other child should think it's on their cheshbon. If you would need the same thing, I get it for you. You don't need it. The time will come, right? My 6-year-old daughter says, hey, you're buying the 19-year-old a wedding dress. How can you buy me a wedding dress? When you'll be 19 and you'll be getting married, I'll buy you a wedding dress. Right now, you don't need it. As long as the children know that the parents are willing to do for everyone what they need, when they need it. At this time, you don't need it, and the other one needs it. Or even if sometimes I had once gave a shiur to parents of children with special needs, and many times in the family there's resentment that they spend a lot of time with the handicapped child, right? With the child that's mentally impaired, that child gets a tremendous amount of the budget of the family goes to them, and because of that, the other children can't get what they need. They can't get the time of the parent. They can't get the money that they should be spent on them. The parent has to let the child know, it's not because I favor that child over you. It's just because the child's needs are greater. And at this point, that's where I have to put my time, my effort. It's not because I don't think you're worth the same time. It's just that there's only a certain amount of time, and their need at this point is greater. But if you would have the same need, then when you have that need, you'll get it too. The child should never feel that the parent is consciously favoring another child over this one. You have the same need, you have the same, what's it called, and I get him and not you. As long as you make it clear to your children, and you don't make it clear to them by telling them this, you make it clear by the way that you function, that everybody knows that when their need comes up, they're the ones who get what they have to get. And it's only a question of priorities because of need, not because of favoritism. So you can't obviously treat all children the same, but you can make it clear you're not doing it because you favor that child. You're doing it. The brothers felt that Yaakov gave Yosef something that they all deserved, and he gave it on their account. That was the problem, right? It wasn't what Yaakov meant, but they interpreted it like that. So no one should ever give their children the reason to think that one is being favored at the expense of the other. But that doesn't mean you always have to give all the children equally the same thing. That's the idea. Yeah?
If the Torah says not to favor one child over the other, so why do we have a whole din of bechor?
Because the parent isn't favoring the child, the Torah is favoring. Right? God can take the criticism. But not, right? Blame God. Don't let the child blame the parents. Okay, another thing from the Sedra. It says that Yaakov Avinu curses the anger of Shimon and Levi right? Because they killed out the whole city of Shechem, which they've endangered, what's it called, the whole fledgling nation, that the people, the nations now would have an excuse to kill us. It didn't work out like that, right? It was successful that they were able to fend off any kind of damage. No damage happened, just the opposite. They got the city of Shechem. But Yaakov still said, I think I saw from the Chama Leibowitz, I don't remember who she quoted, but it's the credit to where I saw it. It says that Yaakov, what's it called, was afraid that when Shimon and Levi killed out the whole city of Shechem, that this would give a good excuse to the nations around to decimate us. You can kill them, innocent people, we can kill you. Right? We know that the nations of the world don't need too much of an excuse to, you know, pounce on us, even when we do things that are okay. Right? Even when we kill three murderers, we are taken to... how come you did that? Right? Nobody bothers to ask the murderers why they, how could they do what they did. But if we kill the murderers, then we have to know how can we executed three people who killed a poor man who had seven children or whatever. It's beyond belief, right? What the nations of the world can do. But that was, Yaakov was afraid. In the end, it was not, that's not what happened. So why did Yaakov in the end curse the anger of Shimon and Levi? Right? Lemaisa, what he was afraid of, didn't come out. Says Nechama Leibowitz, in the name of somebody, none of the names of God is success. You don't judge things by success. You judge them on their merits, if they're right or wrong. What Shimon and Levi did was wrong, because it endangered the entire Jewish people of the time. Right? And therefore, even though in the end they were lucked out and nothing bad happened, that doesn't make what they did right. Because if you look at success as a measuring stick, right, of whether something's right or wrong, the Catholic Church is pretty successful, right? There's a lot of things in this world that are bad that are successful, and there are a lot of things in this world that are good that are miserable failures. That doesn't make one right and the other one wrong. You have to judge things on their merit, and that's what Yaakov said. What they did was wrong. I remember to tell you how that was their kanos. Their kanos was, we're not going to be careful of what we do, but the end justifies the means. If our intention, the end, is good, then we don't care about the means. And you can do things that are totally irresponsible, not caring of what the repercussions are going to be, because what we intend to do, the end result is good, and therefore it justifies anything we do. That is not a Jewish concept. The end doesn't justify the means. And especially to act in an irresponsible way. I'll tell you where I once gave a drush on this. It was this sedra. I was a rabbi in Miami, and I went to a dinner, a Young Israel dinner in New York. So I flew into New York, and in those days people didn't meet me at the plane, so I had to take a bus into Borough Park from I think it was LaGuardia at the time. In any case, so I get this bus, and I get off the... what's it called, the periphery of Borough Park, and this is already, that part of Borough Park was not Jewish, it was Puerto Rican, and I see that there is a mass of people at some public school, and there's all the news, radio, television, right, it's something big is going on. So I asked somebody, what's going on over here? They said, well, there were some firebombings of synagogues in the area, and two young Jews from a certain group, which I won't mention the name, right? Beat up some Puerto Ricans to make a statement that you don't do this to Jews, and we take it, we're going to fight back. Now, they didn't necessarily beat up the people who firebombed the shuls. They just indiscriminately picked two Puerto Ricans off the street and said, you're going to suffer for your friends who firebombed the shul and beat you up. So they had a whole big protest against the fact that these two Puerto Ricans were beaten up, innocent people, they didn't do anything, and whatever. That was the protest. Okay. So I got out of there pretty fast. Since I looked, I guess, Jewish. And I'm walking down the street, And all of a sudden I notice four Puerto Ricans surrounding me, one on each side with iron poles in their hands. Now, first I thought maybe this is a welcoming committee, you know, that they heard I'm coming to New York. Then I realized that maybe that's not what's going on here. So the guy says to me, one of them says, "Your friends beat up our friends." I said, "I don't have any friends here. I'm from Miami. I don't know anybody here. Nobody is my friends here. So my friends couldn't have beaten up your friends." They said, "Well, you're not going to ever get back to Miami." Then I realized that maybe this is serious. So I figured I have to do two things. One is say Tehillim, and secondly, to engage them in conversations so they don't remember what they were planning to do. So I started talking to them. I said, "Well, can you tell me who my friends are, supposedly, what they did, why they do it?" And I started to talk, and they got all involved in the talking, and we really got involved in the conversation. And then I said, and meanwhile I'm saying Tehillim under my breath the whole time, right? And then I said to them, "It's been nice talking to you, but I really have to go now." And I turned, and they kept walking straight. And as soon as I was out of their vision, I ran as fast as I probably could have run faster than those Nigerian guys or whatever. I probably set a world record. I never ran so fast in my life. And I realized, you know, they got basically involved in what I was talking about, and they forgot what they wanted to do. Or the Rabbanu Shlomo made a nace, one of the two, and they just kept walking on, and I got out of there. I went back to Miami, and I gave a drasha about this. You know, sometimes you can do something and you think that you're doing something right, but it's irresponsible, because you don't know what the repercussions are. What's going to happen to me? What did you put me into? What did you accomplish by beating up two Puerto Ricans? You made a statement. Did you get the people who bombed the shul? No. But Kano, sometimes being a zealot has to have a certain amount of responsibility with it. And that's what Shimon and Levi did wrong. Yaakov Avinu is the one to make decisions like this. He has the responsibility of the entire family, the entire family on his shoulders. You put them all in danger. You did something you thought was right, but the end doesn't justify the means. Right? Because irresponsible, not because it hurt Shem, because it could have hurt the Jewish people. That was the point. What? No, so then there are ways of doing things. Yaakov was thought what they were going to do is make them all get a bris, be weak, go in, kill Shem and Hamor, who are the perpetrators, and take the daughter back. That he was 100% for. But why did you kill the whole people, the whole nation? What did they do? Why did you have to kill they weren't innocent people. But why did you have to kill the whole city, which the nations considered innocent people? You could have justified killing the perpetrators, getting your daughter, getting your sister back. But you couldn't justify, even if it was halachically justifiable, it wasn't justifiable in the eyes of the people. And you put us in danger because of that. It wasn't, that wasn't okay. That kind of kanos, irresponsible kanos, is not okay. Just to do, because somebody has to do something, you have to do something that makes sense, that will have a good result, not cause more trouble than you accomplish something. So it's interesting. What did Yaakov do? What was his curse to Shimon and Levi? That they should become school teachers. Now, if you're a school teacher, there's no question. Okay? So, good, great curse. But it really doesn't make sense. What does one thing have to do with the other? The answer is, where's the opposite of the end justifying the means? The what's it called? Chinuch. Chinuch is, we want to get a child conditioned to do what's right. It's not the end, because there is no end. He's not liable to any mitzvahs or whatever. There's no real benefit of what he's doing. It's just to get into the practice of doing something right. Here's the opposite. It's the means that are the most important, not the end. Right? If you want somebody to do what's right, you have to condition them to do what's right. You can't do what's right by conditioning people to do what's wrong. And that would be the cure of misplaced zealousy. Being zealous in a misplaced way is saying the means don't make a difference. It's what the goal is. And chinuch is the opposite. The means mean everything. And you only reach the goal if you have the right kinds of means. You can't get a kid to end up okay if you let him constantly do things that aren't okay. You have to condition him to doing what's okay. That's the connection. What you said, though, that Yosef forgave his brothers, he never really forgave them. In fact, Rabbi David Kronglass, who was the Mashgiach in Ner Yisrael, said the following. It says when Rabbi Akiva would come to the sentence, Isha hafeiram v'Hashem yislach lo. From there we learn that if you intend to do something bad, but it works out for the good, you still need to do tshuva. You still need to be forgiven. The example is that, we spoke about this at some time, that somebody intends to eat treif, but by accident he eats kosher. So when he finds out that what he ate was kosher, he still has to do tshuva. Because you intended the bad, so you have to still do tshuva. So when Rabbi Akiva would come to that sentence, he would cry. David Kronglass explained, why Rabbi Akiva, why did he cry at that sentence? Because when the brothers came to Yosef and they said, we did a terrible thing to you, forgive us, we'll be your slaves in the end of this week, etc. Yosef said, you don't need my forgiveness. You meant it for the bad, but God made it work out for the good. It's okay. Right? I have no complaint. It worked out for the good. But that's not true. Because since they meant it for the bad, they do need forgiveness. But since Yosef never forgave them, he just said, you don't need to be forgiven. It's okay. Had he forgiven them, he would have taken away the blemish. But he didn't. He said, you don't need to be forgiven. But he made a mistake. They didn't need to be forgiven. Because he never actively forgave them. The blemish was there. How was the blemish taken away? Many generations later with the 10 martyrs, who Rabbi Akiva was one of them. So Rabbi Akiva foresaw what he was going to have to go through because Yosef never forgave the brothers because he made a mistake into thinking that you don't need to be forgiven, and therefore he cried. Now, there's a problem with that.
The death of the 10 martyrs is a direct result
of the Mechiras Yosef. Right.
Where's that from?
We say it every Yom Kippur.
It's
a medrash, though. It's a medrash. The medrash Asura Haruge Malchus is a medrash like that. In fact, Art Scroll came out with a translation of it recently for Tisha B'Av. It's a whole medrash. In any case, but it's not really true. Because both the Or HaChaim HaKadosh and the Sfarno say that in this situation, Yosef was right. When do you need forgiveness? For instance, you intended to eat treif, and it turned out to be kosher. So you intended to rebel against God. But that doesn't apply to human beings. If I intend to poison you, and instead of giving you poison, I give you wine, right? Do I have to ask your forgiveness? No. Because I didn't do anything. It all worked out for the good. That's what the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says. The Sfarno says Hebrews even worse. They didn't think they were doing something bad. They thought they were doing something good. They were wrong. But in the end, it worked out for the good. So they thought they were doing something good by mistake, and it worked out good. In other words, let's say you have a piece of meat, and it's really kosher, but you thought that it was kosher, but it really was not kosher to begin with, and then it turned out to be kosher. Somehow, like that. That was okay. Because you thought you were doing something good, and even if at that point it wasn't good, but in the end it worked out good, fine. So then, why Taka... Why isn't Yosef right? Because concerning human beings. I don't have to forgive you. You didn't do anything to me. It worked out for the good. But God has to forgive you because you intended to rebel against Him by selling me. That was something between you and God that was no good. So Yosef should have said, don't come to me. I don't have to forgive you. But you better go to God because He has to forgive you. Yeah, fine. But that's a shogeg for that. You need kapara too. When it comes to God, they needed... But Yosef didn't tell them, look, I don't need to forgive you, but God needs to forgive you. Had he done that, then they would have asked Mechila from God, and they would have done tshuva, and maybe it would have erased the blemish. But because Yosef didn't tell them that...
But they do say, this is a result of our selling.
Right, even that, they didn't regret selling him. They regretted not having mercy on him. Maybe we should have been more merciful, but they didn't regret the thing, we were right. But we should have been a little bit more merciful. Even though we were right, but you have to have mercy too. That's what they saw. They never really realized that what they did was 100% wrong. They were convinced that under the circumstances, what they did was okay.
Didn't Yehuda know that he'd done
To a certain degree, yes, but it never reached the final point of coming to closure with it. That's what never came. Because it wasn't closed, there was a blemish left. And that blemish had to be erased from the Jewish people. The only ones who could do it were these great people, that they're dying al kiddush Hashem, which are probably other reasons, erased that blemish.